Hello, everyone. This is Kristen Jefferson with the TRS Coalition. Thank you for your patience as we figure out the sound here with the webinar. If you can hear me, please indicate so in the chat box on the web conferencing screen. Okay, I got a confirmation. Great. All right, well, let's get started since we're starting a little late and we have a full itinerary here. Many of you have participated in some of our earlier webinar series, and that's great. This is our fourth one, and we're going to be focusing on funding opportunities for restoration in Colorado. We have seven speakers who are going to present today, and we're very excited about this event. So, I'm going to give you a quick presentation about how to use the web conferencing system. Everyone will be muted during the presentations except the presenter, so please keep that in mind. Oh, someone can't hear me now. Okay. Can you hear me? Okay, just a moment as we figure this out. Sorry, I apologize. It's always complicated. Okay, can everyone hear me now? It might be necessary for our presenters to call back in, all of you using that same set of that same call number and that same access number. If you would, all seven of you, I apologize for the complication there. If you would just call back in using that information, I think that will avoid the complication, and I apologize to the rest of you. The technical difficulties. In the meantime, I'll give my quick overview of the web conferencing rules. So as mentioned, the content-related questions will be taken after all of the presentations have been completed. Again, we are going to be using the chat box on the left if you have any technical difficulties. I'm also going to ask that everyone please sign in with both your name and your organization and watershed, if that's relevant, so that we know who is participating in this event. I would also ask that everyone use their computers. As you may notice, where you need to both call in and access the computer webpage to be able to participate in the event. You can access audio through the webpage. But it's not, you won't be able to ask questions. You'll need to call in if you want to ask questions in the future. When you do ask questions, please indicate your name and your affiliation. I'm also going to ask that you take notes during the course of the presentation, especially the questions that are going to be oriented or targeted at a specific presenter. Since you have so many presenters, it will make it a lot easier if you know who you're directing your questions to. And at the end of the event, I will provide this link for the survey, but it helps us greatly if you're able to provide information about your experience with our webinar series and whether you found it useful. Some information about some future upcoming webinars. We hope to have some webinars that are focused on sustainable funding tools, funding for restoration in Utah and Arizona, and then another event that covers common pitfalls for grant writing and fundraising. We will announce those dates as they are scheduled. If you have any thoughts on the subject of webinars or any questions for me, you can reach me at kjesperson@samariscoalition.org. So to kick off the event, I was going to provide a quick overview of some funding opportunities that have been the RFPs have come out for and that we do not have presenters speaking about today during the presentation. So I wanted to make you aware of these since they are specific to Colorado. The first is two grant opportunities that are available to the Colorado Department of Agriculture. These are both due on February 22nd. The first is the Noxious Weed Management Fund, which is focused on funding projects that eradicate and contain noxious weeds that on USFS property. You can find out more information about this funding opportunity at our Riparian Restoration Connection.org website, where we post any funding opportunities that are relevant to restoration work. Another funding opportunity available through the Colorado Department of Agriculture is the State and Private Forestry Grant. The purpose of this grant is to eradicate or contain rare and noxious weed species of high priority in the state of Colorado. A third RFP that's currently out is the Colorado Collaboration Award. That is, the grant is due for that on March 15th. And this is a fairly specific grant program that's focused on providing awards to partnerships that demonstrate outstanding collaboration. To be eligible, your partnership needs to have been functioning since 2011, and you need to have a signed MOU in place. So that's good to know before you pursue that grant application. Again, you can find out more information about these and other funding opportunities on our Riparian Restoration Connection.org website. Okay, so I'm going to pull up our first presenter's presentation, and I would like to welcome Chris Sturm. Chris, if you would try and unmute yourself as I give your quick presentation, your intro here. Chris Sturm is the Stream Restoration Coordinator for the Colorado Water Conservation Board. He's been in this position for 5 years. He has a BS in Environmental Science and an MS in Geography from the University of Georgia. His background is in fluvial geomorphology and water rights administration. Chris, are you on the line here?
I am.
Okay, let's get started.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Sorry that I don't have a title slide there, but we'll jump right in because there's not a whole lot of time for each presentation. Not 100% sure who all my audience is, so I thought it'd be helpful to throw up an organizational chart to show who we are. We're the Colorado Water Conservation Board, a division within the State Department of Natural Resources. And you can see the other agencies up there in DNR. Our sister agency is the Division of Water Resources. Within the board, we've got several different sections in the Watershed and Flood Protection section. So we'll focus on grant programs offered through that section. But we do offer other services, and I encourage you to check out our website to see what else we do. And here is the website. So if you want to check out on my presentation right now, everything I'm going to be presenting on is under the Loans and Grants tab. Each of the programs I'll be talking about today, all the information can be found under that tab, as well as applications and guidance for the program, different programs. But I'll launch it off with the different grant programs we have in the Watershed and Flood Protection section that would be of interest to this group. The first is the Invasive Free Aphid Control Program. This program is relatively new. It evolved out of what we used to call the Tamarisk and Russian Olive Grant Program, but the board just approved this program in 2012. So very new, and we just received our first round of grant applications in December. I'm also going to talk about the Watershed Restoration Program, which was approved in 2008, the Healthy Rivers Fund, which is part of the Voluntary Tax Donation Checkoff Colorado Program, and that's been around since 2003, and then the Fish and Wildlife Resources Fund, which, to be honest with you, I don't even know when that one started. So going into the invasive phreatophyte control program, which I'll just call IPSIP to save a little time here. Like I said, the board approved it last year, and we received several. Well, I'm going to pull up another spreadsheet here so I don't get the information wrong for you. We received 10 applications in December requesting $721,000, and the initial release is going to be $500,000. So we're going to make a decision on that actually next week. The specifics of the program can be found on the web page, but for us to even consider an application, applicants need to demonstrate that they have a plan to control invasives through this integrated pest management approach, which kind of strategizes the use of chemical, biological, or physical removal of invasives. We also want to see that there's an ongoing plan to control secondary weeds. We're very concerned about the restoration and revegetation of the riparian areas, whether that be passive or active. And we also want to see some kind of monitoring and ongoing maintenance plan for the project. The applicant needs to have at least 50% of the total project cost, and we're willing to match up to 50% of it. The timeline that I'm sure is of interest of this group for the next release, we do have funding for next year, so be accepting applications again probably in the fall of 2013 with notifications about this time in 2014. I don't think it's going to be $500,000 again. It's probably going to be more on the order of $300,000 to $350,000. Project maximum request is $100,000, but I suspect the average award will be less than that, probably on the order of $50,000 to $75,000. Moving into the Watershed Restoration Program, this has been around since 2008. We've funded quite a few projects through this program, and it's my goal to eventually merge the invasive phreatophyte control program with the watershed restoration program. I think it'll fit nicely in there. Applicants need to demonstrate that it's an open process, that they're committed to collaborative approaches and willing to work with all interested parties in the watershed to protect or restore ecological processes that connect land and water. Just like IPSIP, this requires 50% match from the applicant. The timeline on the Watershed Restoration Program is that applications will be available on the website on July 1. The guidance document's on there right now, so if you're interested in reading about it, you can access that. Applications will be due on September 30th of 2013, and then we'll have folks notified before the end of the year. This program used to start in January. I changed it because I never knew if I had the funding from the legislators or not until May or June. So we've got a bit of a lag this year, but I think it'll be a lot easier to administrate now. We'll be able to contract with successful applicants over the winter so they can get started in the field season. Here's just a quick map of the history of the program since 2009, since it started. You can see that the center of the state's represented well. We're lacking projects in the White River and Yampa Basin and on the Eastern Plains. I know that list is probably not easy to read, but what we've got on there, the majority of the projects are bank stabilization and riparian revegetation projects and ditch diversion reconstruction projects, with most of them being the revegetation projects. And that's why I think that the invasive program will fit nicely in this program in the future. Moving on to the Colorado Healthy Rivers Fund, very similar to the Watershed Restoration Program. It's a separate program, though, because we operate it in cooperation with the Water Quality Control Division, which is part of the State Department of Public Health and Environment. And we also do it in consultation with a nonprofit watershed group, the Colorado Watershed Assembly. The match support on this one isn't as great as 50%. It's 20%, and that can be in kind. Maximum grants out of this for planning are $25,000, and for projects are $50,000. But in reality, those average numbers are more of what we're funding each year. We usually only get around $95,000 in donations each year, and we're trying to fund a certain number of projects, so the averages are less than the maximums. Timeline for this one, the application actually is available right now. We didn't do any changes to it this year. Due date will be April 30th, and notifications and grant awards will be September 30th of this year. I have a map of the funding history of the Healthy Rivers Fund. It's very similar to the Watershed Restoration Program. It'd be nice to see some applications from the Eastern Plains as well as the Ample White Basin. And here's the project list again. Kind of not real easy to see, but since we operate this with the Water Quality Control Division, there's more water quality type projects on this list that the CWCB doesn't traditionally fund. There's a lot of watershed planning efforts funded through the Healthy Rivers Fund, as well as bank stabilization, riparian revegetation, diversion reconstruction projects, and macroinvertebrate sampling is starting to be funded more and more because the Water Quality Control Division is interested in that. They're interested in developing a standard. Let's move on from there. Real quick, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you guys how you can donate. It's on line 37 of the state income tax form, and a lot of folks think you just check it and it's a dollar donation, but you can actually pencil in any amount you want. And here's the history of funding of the project. The average number of donations is dropping, but the average donation is increasing, and I think that's a result of some of our targeted marketing approaches. Finally, I have the Fish and Wildlife Resources Fund. There's no deadlines or due dates for this. We take applications as they're submitted. They can fund river restoration projects or the acquisition of water rights. The applicants need to either be the operators of a water facility of which mitigation is desired, or the CWCB. And the CWCB can partner with anyone that wants to move forward with some mitigation to fund that project. And that's all I have. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you, Chris. Next, we're going to have a presentation by Brian Sullivan. I'll pull that up, and if, Brian, you would unmute yourself as I introduce you.
I have done that. Thank you, and good morning, everyone.
Hi. Brian is the Wetlands Program Coordinator for Colorado Parks and Wildlife based in Fort Collins. His major duties include managing the Wetlands Grant Program, disputed finances and contracts, and mapping, testing the state's wetland resources to inform the strategic direction of the program. Welcome, Brian. Thank you for participating, and take it away.
Okay, thanks again, Kristen. This is going to be a very short presentation emphasizing how partners can tap into the funding resources of our wetland and riparian conservation program here with Colorado Parks and Wildlife. And we have some other web resources that I'll emphasize at the end of the presentation here. So the program that I manage, we call it our wetlands program, has two major goals. First, it's to improve the status of declining or at-risk species of wildlife, of course, that are wetland or riparian dependent, and then also to improve the distribution and abundance of ducks and opportunities for waterfowl hunting. So the program, again, is about wildlife. It's about both game and non-game wildlife, which is consistent with the funding sources for the program, which I'll mention in just a minute. But when we're looking at funding a project, you know, the closer it ties back to these goals, the more likely it will be, of course, to receive funding. So what are our priority wildlife species? Again, we have waterfowl. We're primarily looking at 8 species of dabbling ducks, which are the most common waterfowl in Colorado, both in terms of the population abundance and in the harvest. And then our at-risk species come from our state wildlife action plan. We've got a couple dozen or so what we call tier one species with either small populations or declining populations. So here's a glimpse of those at-risk species, bunches of birds, herps, fish, and mammals. Again, all that are wetland or riparian dependent. And, you know, some of these are going to occur in, you know, most basins in the state, so it's generally not hard to find a link to a priority species when you're trying to write up a funding application. Again, the better you can do that by involving a wildlife biologist in the application, you know, the stronger that application will be. We typically run a grant cycle every year. There are some exceptions to that. We typically have about $1 million to work with, but that number does fluctuate annually as well. And the primary funding sources that we have today are, first and foremost, GOCO, the Great Outdoors Colorado Lottery Funds. We get a pretty good portion of that devoted to our agency. And then also hunting and angling license fee dollars, which includes the waterfowl stamps, which to my knowledge is the only dedicated source for wetlands conservation in Colorado. And again, we do a grant cycle annually. The timing is normally somewhere in the late winter to the spring. It tends to vary a little bit. And we're looking at another grant cycle this spring, sometime fairly soon, I expect. And we make a lot of direct email announcements to our partners, our focus area chairs, and ask them to spread the word and get on various listservs. And, of course, we do post that RFA on our website as well. So some of the sideboards to this program are that we fund, through this program, just restoration, enhancement, and creation projects. We have a separate program within the agency. We call it our Habitat Protection Program. That's managed by Diane Gansauer. And that's where the big money is for habitat protection, you know, conservation easements and acquisitions. And so, again, the funds for my program are restoration and enhancement primarily. We do fund project planning and design costs within our grants. And to date, we have not directly funded monitoring and evaluation activities. We've allowed those as match. We recognize the importance of those activities, and we're trying to change that criteria within our program. And hopefully, the next grant cycle or two, we'll be able to fund those activities directly. We do allow $100,000 as a maximum award for an individual project. Although we do award also what we call block grants, that has to have at least two projects within that application, and they don't need to be very well planned out in advance. There can be a good concept, for example, within a watershed, and you're going to work on private lands. The landowners can be lined up later, and the specific projects can be detailed later. So, again, we allow a lot of flexibility there, and we offer those at up to $200,000. We do not require matching funds except for projects that will be on non-Parks and Wildlife public land. So if you work with a public land management agency such as Fish and Wildlife Service or BLM or whatever, we do require a one-to-one minimum match on those projects. Otherwise, match is not absolutely required. It is encouraged, of course, and it is also rewarded in our scoring criteria. And we have a maximum three-year window to complete projects. That's aligned with the shelf life of the funds that we have available. And, of course, there are some strings attached. We do require a brief quarterly update throughout the course of the project and then a final report once it's finished. We do fund a wide range of wetland and riparian restoration and enhancement activities or habitat treatments, if you will. And here's just a list. I won't go through all of these here, but you can take a look here. And there are others, of course. And again, everything is really tied back to improving wildlife habitat. And, of course, that's done through altering the hydrology and or vegetation of a site. So, again, we fund a wide range of activities to do that. That's all I have today. This was very brief, the nuts and bolts of how to tap into our funding. Hopefully you will see an announcement within the next two or three months here. There's some contact information for me here on this last slide. And, again, we have some web pages for this program. We have our strategic plan posted there. We post the funding RFAs when they're available. There is a summary of our annual grant awards there and some nice maps, as you just saw from Chris Sturm, are available for this program, too, on those pages. There's contact information for some of our what we call wetland focus area committees, our networks of partners out there for local assistance with projects. Some project accomplishments reports have been posted, but we're way behind in getting some of the recent things posted. And then information on our waterfowl stamp program. So feel free to check out those resources on our web pages or contact me directly if you have any questions.
Just a couple of reminders for those of you who joined the webinar a little bit later. We are reserving all questions until the very end, at which point I will instruct you as to how to ask questions of our presenters. In the meantime, I recommend you write down any questions for the presenter's presentation, and if you would remember who to direct it to at that point in time. Now we are going to introduce Pat Parker, who is also from Colorado Parks and Wildlife. He is the state coordinator for the Habitat Partnership Program. He's been with Parks and Rec since 1980, working in various temporary positions, including property maintenance, warm and cold water fisheries, and peregrine falcon surveys. Pat, are you on the line?
I am. Thank you.
Thanks, go ahead. Everybody.
Thanks. Good afternoon. I'm the Habitat Partnership Program Coordinator, and we will also do just a brief overview of this program. That's the managed and run by the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Agency. The key to the Habitat Partnership Program is our local committees, and as the map shows, we have them scattered over much of the West Slope and the northern and southern parts of the Front Range, with one in Yuma and Washington County. These local committees have funding, they have an operating plan, and they have the authority to solicit projects, entertain proposals, approve those, and fund those at their local level. And they really are the link to the HPP program. It's a much decentralized program, with the local committees being the on-the-ground implementers of the program. Annually, we receive 5% of license sales from those species that are there, and about $2 million, depending on sales. But as everyone else, we depend entirely on partnerships, and we don't necessarily set a rule as to what the partnership looks like or what the match should be in terms of percentages or cash versus in-kind versus labor. But in any project that you were to submit to the HPP program, to the local committees, that matching partnership is essential and pretty much required to be able to get funded. One of the key things that everybody gets based on is our intent is to assist private landowners with big game conflicts. And so we can do projects anywhere that they're going to resolve those conflicts on public or private property. But again, they've got to be tied back to assisting private landowners, private agricultural operators, primarily with big game conflicts. That's our statutory purpose. That's what we were set up 23 years ago, and that's still the main focus that the local committees put. So if you are contemplating a project, please look towards those things as being the first filter to go through. And of course, as I said, there's that partnerships and leveraging of money and the short-term fixes and long-term solutions to problems with that that the committees are all going to use to evaluate you on. The best way to do a project is contact your local DWM, which is a district wildlife manager for our agency. We have them in every community throughout the state. Perhaps another agency colleague or even committee members or one of our offices. They have all the information that you might need to submit a proposal for HPP. We also have periodic meetings in various areas and those committee areas that are open to the public, and you can certainly find out that schedule from our office. As with anybody who's been around for 23 years, we have lots of people who have done projects before. Again, this is an agricultural program, and so you'd be wanting to talk to either the public agency folks that are involved with the permittees or with the private landowner ranchers and stuff, but there's plenty of those out there to see what they've done. Our website, which is that last bullet on there, does have all the project proposals, that map, contact information that you might need to be able to see more about what we're about. Typical habitat projects we get involved with, we do it all. We're interested in all the types of various habitat work, including noxious weed control, but other things that's going to help us with those big game agricultural conflicts that exist out there. And so that's where our focus is. Committees are very open to people who have projects or ideas and have brought some partnerships to the table to consider funding them and seeing if we can't, you know, make any progress in some of the issues out there. And, of course, there's our website one more time again, and my contact information is there along with other program information, applications, past summaries, as well as a map to see if you're in one of our committee areas that we have to work within. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Pat. And a reminder that all of these presentations will be made available on our website, www.tamaristcoalition.org, after the webinar has been concluded within the next week. So if you have information like that you'd like to be able to collect or gather or revisit, that will be available to you on our website. Next, I would like to introduce Naomi Marcus. And if Naomi, unmute yourself. Naomi is the Forest Stewardship Coordinator for the Colorado State Forest Service. She's worked with the Colorado State Forest Service for the last 10 years as a field forester and a program manager. She facilitates landowner participation in forest stewardship programs that support active forest management in Colorado. Naomi, are you there?
I am.
Okay, great. Take it away.
Great. Thank you very much. Today I'm just going to go a little deeper into one of our programs, the Forest Restoration Grant Program, give a little context of the history through state legislation and how this program became what it is today, as well as basic eligibility criteria, some examples of projects that we have funded in the past, as well as some additional tips to keep in mind should either you or any of your partners are interested in applying towards this grant program. Before I get into a little bit more about this program, if you are interested in any of the other funding opportunities that the Colorado State Forest Service administers, I encourage you to either contact your local State Forest Service district offices, as well as check out our funding opportunities webpage. As of right now, the Colorado Forest Restoration Grant Program is the only grant that is currently accepting applications. To reiterate some of the themes that have come out in the discussions so far today is partnerships and collaboration. And really the essence of the Forest Restoration Grant Program is looking at projects that demonstrate community-based approaches of forest restoration. Just to give a little bit of history and context of the legislation that's come out for this grant program, the Forest Restoration Grant Program actually started off as the Forest Restoration Pilot Grant Program. It was piloted for quite a few years, starting off in 2007 when Colorado General Assembly really made a big push and huge support of forest management in Colorado and authorized House Bill 1130. And at that time, the funding had originated by the support of Colorado Water Conservation Board. And come around 2008, the legislative session decided to authorize Senate Bill 71 with the big transition of the program, which was its funding source. And currently, through the various iterations of the legislation, the funding for the Forest Restoration Grant Program comes from the operational account, the severance tax for the state. In 2009, we had House Bill 1199, and just this past year, Colorado General Assembly wanted to continue the program, still tapping into the operational account of the severance tax. However, the program is no longer considered piloted, and that's how we are now referring to it as the Forest Restoration Grant Program. And the map is giving you an idea as to that these projects, we are looking at awarding projects across the state. We are not focusing in just one specific area. And this is a 60-40 cost share program. And another two other main components of this grant program is that there is an advisory panel, interagency advisory panel, that's required to review and provide recommendation, review the proposals and provide recommendations to the state forester to determine which projects will be awarded. And that advisory panel is made up of myself representing the Colorado State Forest Service, a member of Department of Natural Resources, at least one member of a federal land management agency, two research scientists who have experience with the topics of ecological restoration, as well as equal representation from community, commodity, and conservation interests. And another huge component of this legislation with this grant program is projects are strongly encouraged to utilize the Colorado Youth Corps. This gives you an idea as to some of the accomplishments that have come out of the awards for this grant program. So in summary, we have awarded 86 projects, including the round of funding of projects that are currently being implemented. Over $4.7 million worth of state funds have hit the ground with the various projects, and the award funds had also leveraged an additional $1 million of federal funds. And then those grant recipients who did receive funds to implement the projects had leveraged another $8 million. So it really goes to show that there's a huge community support in implementing these forest restoration projects. And as a result of this program, we have treated over 12,000 acres since about that 2007-2008 time frame. Just to reiterate some of the basic eligibility components, once again, is 60-40 cost share, which means the state share will not exceed 60% of the total project cost. The project location needs to be within the state boundaries of Colorado. Projects need to be captured under a community wildfire protection plan, and that information can you can look to see if your community is within a CWPP by looking on our website. We do post all community wildfire protection plans that have been approved by the Colorado State Forest Service on our website. And we also require all projects to consider how their project is addressing one of the strategies specified in our Forest Action Plan, which you may be more familiar with as our Statewide Forest Resource Assessment and Strategy. Both of those documents are available on our website as well. And these projects, our primary objective to be met is how the forest restoration is going to provide some sort of watershed protection or protection to source water supply. And other secondary objectives that we anticipate projects to address is how they utilize small timber and making use of the forest products from the project areas, as well as reducing fire risk and retaining large trees, as well as reforesting some of the deforested areas in the state. As far as the funding that is available, the legislation has authorized up to $1 million, and similar to some of the other grant programs, that money, so that we don't know the exact dollar amount until the spring, which is right around the time that we do award the funds. And I'll go over timeline in just a bit. So as you start thinking about some of the projects and partners that you want to work with, we want to make sure that with these limited funds that they do have the greatest impact and a meaningful impact on the landscape. So we encourage applicants to consider larger contiguous landscapes and how their project may impact the greater watershed. Partnerships is absolutely critical. They're critical to the design of your project, as well as pursuing various sources of contribution to satisfy the matching requirement. We also encourage all projects to discuss and address how they implement best management practices. And as mentioned, since this restoration grant program is decisions and are being made based off of an advisory panel who come from very different perspectives, to think outside your shoes, outside your own perspective, and making sure proposals are designed and crafted so that anyone who's reading it knows exactly what the project is about. To give a few examples of some of the projects down in the Central Front Range and Teller Park counties, we've had some funds go to the Coalition for Upper South Platte, implementing activities such as fuel mitigation, seedling planting projects, and plenty of volunteers were used in this particular project, as well as the forest products were contributed to the local community. A little further north in the high country, this project with Buffalo Creek Ranch was unique in that the forest management was implemented not only on the ranch property, but it crossed the boundary onto Bureau of Land Management land, and over 130 loads, semi-truck loads of wood products came out of this project and were utilized within our local Colorado wood markets, including going to a couple of our pellet mills. And notably, especially by the sponsor of this webinar, Tamarsk Coalition has received a number of awards from the Forest Restoration Pilot Grant Program, and they are one of many projects who have utilized the Colorado Youth Corps in the implementation of the project, and their focus was on eradicating the invasive tree species and even went to the extent of implementing some native willow plantings. And Kerber Creek is another riparian restoration project that we have funded. This one focuses more on stream stabilization for the purpose of enhancing water quality and quantity. And they also planted some native willow, alder, and cottonwoods. So just real quickly, giving you an idea, since we are currently accepting applications, the deadline to the local State Forest Service District offices is February 27th. Districts will be facilitating the initial screening and review, so be sure to contact your local district office if there's any preliminary deadlines to make sure that your application is complete and eligible for a full competition with the rest of the applications submitted at the state level. And soon after that, I will receive the applications, and then I will forward them out to that interagency advisory panel. And over a course of a month, we will review those, and within a day, we will discuss those applications and then pass up those recommendations to the state forester. I typically get the notifications to those who will be awarded funds as well as those who will not receive funding this round and encouraged to apply next year by end of spring, early summer. And just as something to keep in mind when you're completing those applications, I think if you talk to any one of us, is to always triple check your applications, making sure those boxes are checked and completed and that the cost share rates are satisfied, because these are critical eligibility requirements, and we want your application to compete as opposed to being turned down because of its lack of completeness. So with that, I do encourage anyone who has a question of whether or not their project is applicable and relevant towards the intent of the state legislation and this grant program, they can contact either myself or the local district office. And it looks like we'll be taking questions at the end of all the presentations. So thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. Great. Next we have Rachel Wilson-Russell. Rachel is the Supplemental Environmental Projects Program Coordinator for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. She has participated in the negotiation of over 200 projects totaling more than $15 million that bring environmental and public benefits back to communities affected by violations of environmental laws and regulations. Rachel, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Let's get started.
Great. Thank you for that introduction. So this is a little bit of a departure from what you've heard thus far. CDPHE has regulatory authority over several environmental laws and regulations. And when these private entities violate those regulations, the department can assess a penalty through an environmental enforcement action. And through that process, the entity may be able to mitigate a portion of their penalty by voluntarily agreeing to participate in a SEP. So what is a SEP exactly? Essentially, it's a project that has an environmental or public health benefit that's implemented voluntarily as the result of enforcement action. And so because SEPs are voluntary, it's important to note that the department doesn't have the authority to require an entity to fund any particular project, nor a SEP in general. So their option is they can always pay their penalty in full to the state general fund. All settlements require violators to achieve and maintain compliance with applicable regulations. So that means a SEP has to go above and beyond what's already required for compliance. And lastly, we do have a department-wide SEP policy, so the project needs to comply with that policy. Just a couple of notes about the photos on this page. The top photo is of the Hotchkiss Fire District solar project. They added 6 kW of solar PV to their building through a SEP. They also leveraged funds from the USDA, a USDA grant, and so the SEP ended up paying for about 43% of the project. The bottom photo is of a Trout Unlimited organized volunteer planting day on the Rhone Plateau. So the volunteers planted native species there. Moving forward, in order to be eligible for a SEP, you need to either be a regulated entity in an enforcement action, in which case we do have special requirements. For example, the Atmel Corporation in Colorado Springs decided to implement an odor reduction program on site at their facility. Their total project cost was over $400,000, but we were only allowed a penalty mitigation of $80,000. So for first-party SEPs, we require a mitigation ratio, and this ensures that a regulated entity is not actually benefiting from the SEP. They're actually putting in more money than required into the project. Or you can also be a governmental entity and be the beneficiary of a third-party SEP donation or a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Typically, our third-party SEP donations receive a one-to-one penalty mitigation ratio, which makes them a bit more attractive. So for every dollar donated, that regulated entity receives $1 worth of penalty mitigation. The photos here are of a 2004 Sand Creek Regional Greenway project in Commerce City, and then a 2009 project on the bottom there to establish a one-mile nature trail. And the nature trail is actually a good example of a project that was implemented by the regulated entity, and in which case I think there was a 3-to-1 mitigation ratio. So they had to spend 3 times the amount that we mitigated of their penalty for that project. Our SEP policy outlines 6 major categories of projects. So as you can see here, they are quite broad in scope, and pollution prevention includes such things as source reduction, alternative and renewable energy, waste minimization, and in-process recycling, conservation, and energy efficiency. Our environmental restoration and protection category is probably what most interests folks on this call today, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But we also do projects that involve environmental education and training, as well as public health. So there are a variety of different ways that you can assess access SEP funds. And here, the top photo is actually a former hotel in Rifle, Colorado. It was constructed in 1896. And through a Clean Energy Economy for the Region SEP, they received $137,000 to help fund energy efficiency projects for commercial businesses in Rifle and Parachute. So that's one of the projects we supported. The bottom photo, we approved a project with the Colorado Division of Wildlife to implement a habitat improvement project for the Gunnison sage grouse on 32 acres of the John Kane tract of the Dan Noble State Wildlife Area. So if we get a little bit more involved in our environmental restoration and protection projects and what we mean by that, first of all, it's important that I note again, if the project is implemented by the regulated entity, the one who's in the enforcement action, it has to go beyond repairing the damage that's needed to remediate the damage done by the violation. So it can't just be they're already required to remediate their damage, so it has to go above and beyond that if they're going to do it. The photos are of a recently completed project administered by the Nature Conservancy to treat Russian knapweed and tamarisk along 5 miles of the Dolores River in north of Gateway, Colorado. And as far as our SEP stats, our total SEP allocations in 2012 were about $2.25 million. We funded 28 projects, and the average amount of funding per project was around $80,000. But, however, when you look at our range, you'll see that doesn't give you the full story, as our projects range from $1,600 to $315,000. But the percent of SEPs that have received under $100,000 in 2012 was about 71%. So most of the projects receive under $100,000, although we do some larger projects. This is a breakdown of the different types of projects that we funded in 2012. As you can see, environmental restoration and protection was about 10% of the funding. Our SEP policy does have a preference for pollution prevention projects. And so any way that you can combine pollution prevention with restoration projects would be to your advantage. This is just a map of Colorado and where projects were funded in 2012. This changes somewhat year to year, but certainly follows where we have the most activity in terms of industry, oil and gas activity, where you would expect to have a larger regulated population. So in 2012, I think the areas with the largest amount of funding was actually the Denver metro area. Weld County has certainly benefited from SEPs in the past, just not in 2012 for some reason. But so it is somewhat spread across the state. So we are constantly collecting SEP ideas. And we don't have deadlines like other more formal grant programs. Our hope is that through soliciting for SEP ideas, we're providing local governments and nonprofits a way to communicate project priorities for your communities. And having the project ideas on hand up front for us reduces the administrative resources needed to seek out projects. So it reduces the time required to include a SEP into a settlement agreement, which are both major barriers to implementing SEPs. And once we receive your project idea, it's reviewed to make sure that it adheres to our SEP policy. And then if it does, it would remain on our SEP idea list for 2 years. And it's also good to note that what we're looking for in our SEP idea form is not a full-out grant application. This is really the beginning stages of project ideas, back-of-the-envelope calculation, budget ranges. You can even submit an idea for a variety of different funding ranges. So if you know you can scale up your project to a certain amount, we can be flexible in accepting that kind of proposal as well. And just a few tips for filling out the idea form. Any quantitative metrics and outcomes that you can provide are always helpful. It's really important to think about other project benefits as well, jobs and educational opportunities. And don't assume your audience understands the importance of your work, except because it's so broad. We get people as diverse as lawyers looking at these ideas, enforcement staff that may not have a background in your work. We also work extensively with environmental health and safety managers. And so it's really important that you talk about why your project is important and why it deserves funding. Also, although we do not require any matching or leveraging, it's always great to see opportunities where we can leverage the SEP funds with other opportunities. And as I mentioned before about the Hotchkiss project, you know, the SEP funds only covered 43% of the project, and the remaining was made up through the fire department funds itself and the USDA grant. And certainly, this is my contact information. If you have any questions about filling out the form or you just want to talk more in depth about the type of projects that are acceptable, feel free to give me a call anytime. I'd love to talk and talk more about how you can best fill out your SEP idea form. That's about it.
Great. Thank you, Rachel. I know that this is sort of a unique program that Rachel just spoke about, so if we don't have adequate time for all of you to ask your questions during the final part of the webinar, then please feel free to contact her. Okay, great. So our next presenter is Dave Kanzer. Dave can unmute himself. Dave is the senior watcher for River District, located in Glenwood Springs. As part of his diverse duties, Dave manages the River District's grant program to help fund creative solutions that address the many water quantity and quality issues facing the Colorado River Basin within the district. Dave, are you there?
I'm here. Hopefully everybody can hear me. Good afternoon.
Great.
Really appreciate the opportunity to join in. And like the previous speaker, this is a little bit of a departure, possibly, for the audience. But I think it's I definitely appreciate the opportunity to talk about what we're trying to do with our water supply project grant program. And I'll talk a little bit about what the River District is as I go through here and then, of course, get into the details of the grant program. Hopefully this will advance. As I clicked once, it does not seem to be. So maybe, Kristen, you can help me out. Okay. So you can see by this map here, the Colorado River District and our mission. We are basically a water policy and planning entity for the Colorado River within the state of Colorado. You can see the mission there to protect, conserve, use, and develop the water resources of the River District and the Colorado River Basin within the state, and not only for the district, but to safeguard it for all users within the state of Colorado. Having said that, though, the grant program is limited to our geographic limit. We have 15 counties, and the next slide will show that which counties those are. Hopefully they will advance. I'm not sure why it's not advancing for me, but in any case, these 15 counties are shown. I didn't see too many people on the webinar within the district, but assuming you can see this, and if you're within these 15 counties, all or parts of these 15 counties, you're eligible for our grant program. And the next slide. We'll also go into more detail about the River District, how we're funded. We've been around quite a while, 75 years. We just celebrated our anniversary, set up at the same time as Chris Sturm's Colorado Water Conservation Board in 1937. We take up about 28% of the state. We have directors from each of the county. We are both tax-based, and we have what's known as a water activity enterprise. These funds are generated and supply our free money program, as our next slide shows. And our grant program, again, entitled Free Money Here, was established in 98. It's a unified cost share program for both large and small projects. Originally, it was differentiated, but now these projects can come and compete for up to $150,000 per project. That total cost represents about 25% of the total project cost, so we're not the only funder for these projects. So if you have a $600,000 project set, that's the minimum amount you would be necessary to get a grant of $150,000. Each year, our board appropriates $250,000 for this grant program for to help with water supply projects. The application period is open right now. It's generally open 2 months from December to January, with final funding decisions in April. And the next slide shows the 8 primary water supply objectives that we have. And just briefly, I don't need to read every single one of them, but it's essentially designed to develop, enhance, improve water supply systems, whether they're raw water, treated water, for irrigation or municipal uses. Even industrial uses could qualify. We also provide monies to help improve water use efficiency, help improve water quality, control sediment. Probably the last two are of most interest to this group, maybe, and those our grant program can support the undertaking of a watershed action. It's not as good for studies, but this program will and can support actions identified in watershed plans. And likewise, our program can also help implement TAMRS control, which, of course, is of interest to several on the call. We have funded several large-scale TAMRS eradication programs. PNC has been a successful applicant, that's the Nature Conservancy, and others. And so I can talk more about that if appropriate. But as we keep going through here, we are geared towards protecting what we call pre-Colorado River Compact water rights. And we'll leave it at that. If you have a water right that's 1922 or earlier, you kind of are favored in our program. The next slide talks a little bit more about the application process. And you can see this is it's a single page. It's very, in my mind, simple application process. Obviously, you've got a series of minimum elements to provide. I should note, like Chris and others, all of this information is on our website, ColoradoRiverDistrict.org, and you'll see that throughout the slides coming up. But essentially, give a minimum description about what you're trying to do, where the monies are coming from, who's going to benefit, budgeting information, the standard things that most grant programs require. We certainly require. We do give out grants to small users, and we understand, you know, some folks that are not necessarily as technically adept. They can do these things by hand, mail them in. They can fax them or fill them in online. The more detail, the better, of course. And the next slide talks about how we evaluate processes, and I think I've got a numbering problem. This is one of two. Sorry about that. But essentially, this slide shows how the applicants are ranked by appropriateness, project description, budget, funding, milestone, and timelines. Those are all on that previous form that is downloadable. Again, pretty straightforward. All these ranking criteria are online for review. The better you fill out these things and provide the information for each of these categories. Also shown in the next slide, continues on. Technical adequacy, project effectiveness, sponsor capability, cost effectiveness and participation. Even intangible benefits are quantified and help us decide which grants to fund under our program. I think we jumped ahead. There should be one more slide here that talks about successful applicants. Not sure why that's not in there, but I will just talk about it briefly as you have a little laugh on my last slide. We have in the past funded things such as reservoir construction and rehabilitation, pipeline, canal construction and replacement, water measurement distribution devices to help water efficiency. We've also sponsored projects that create storage tank construction, on-farm irrigation improvements, such as sprinklers to help the non-point source issues for water quality, of course, stream bank stabilization, tamarisk eradication, as I mentioned. And lately, we've been involved in two large projects in conjunction with CWCB's watershed program Chris Term talked about for in-channel improvements. We have granted monies to several entities that have put in fish-friendly diversion structures, and be happy to talk about more of these successful applicants and answer questions as we go forward. But again, all information is online at coloradoriverdistrict.org. And I think you'll be able to get a hold of me through Kristen should you have additional questions going forward. So it was a lot to throw at you. I appreciate your time and Kristen for putting this together.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dave. Okay, our final presentation is by Sandra Vangit. And I'm going to pull up her presentation here. Sandra is the manager of corporate giving for Xcel Energy in Colorado. In that role, she is responsible for coordinating Xcel Energy's charitable giving, including managing the Xcel Energy Foundation's grant-making and statewide United Way campaign. She works with a cross-functional team that promotes and manages other community investment activities, including sponsorships, volunteerism, board placements, and employee engagement. Sandra, are you there?
I am here. Thank you.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Oh. You know what? It's not letting me advance the slides either. Can you advance to the next one? Oh, there we go. So I'd just like to start to remind people of who Xcel Energy is and what we do. We're a little different than all the other funders on this webinar in that we actually are a corporation and we're not in business to give away money, although we get to. We're an investor-owned utility that provides electricity and natural gas throughout the Midwest. Here in Colorado, we're one of eight states that Xcel Energy serves, and we have about 1.37 million electricity customers and 1.31 million natural gas customers here in the state. Coincidentally, the budget for how we determine our grants cycle in each state is based on a formula with our based on profits, number of employees, customers, et cetera. Here in Colorado, our budget each year is around 1.3 to 1.4 million. This year, we're at about the 1.4, which is nice. Through our foundation, that's how we do most of our work in the community. We're different than private foundations in that we're not endowed. We get an allocation every year directly from our shareholders of the company, basically the profits, and they give us the money to do the work we do out in the community through the foundation. So with that, we funded four key focus areas. The environment is what we'll be talking about today, but just so you know, the other three areas that we work in are STEM education, and that's really from kindergarten through collegiate level. We work in economic self-sufficiency, which is a priority on workforce development, job training, and job creation. And then we fund programs that provide access to arts and culture, including arts education for K-12 kids. With our environmental focus area grants, the reason that this is one of our primary areas of giving is it really ties to our corporate environmental strategy, trying to be an environmental leader in the energy industry. So we really look at ways that we can build partnerships that enhance the environment and that foster an ethic of stewardship, conservation, and preservation. So within that, we sort of take two approaches into the type of grant making that we do. The first is we do environmental education, and we support programs that do K-12 EE for students outside of the classroom. So programs that take the learning out into the field and provide hands-on experiences learning science and linking that back to what the kids are doing in school. We don't fund K-12 schools directly. We work with nonprofit partners to help provide these enhanced learning opportunities. We provide a lot of grants for direct service to youth in these EE programs throughout the state. We also really focus on, through all of our educational funding, teacher effectiveness and teacher quality. So we fund other programs through nonprofit organizations that provide more of the training and support and resources to improve the quality and effectiveness of environmental educators. One of our major partners in this arena is the Colorado Alliance for Environmental Education, and we do a lot of work with them to help provide the teacher training, professional development, and other work to support environmental educators. The other part of our environmental grants where most of you are probably most interested, where most of you are most interested is really in the environmental stewardship category. And we do a variety of projects that are eligible for our support that kind of tend to fall into these three subcategories, habitat and park projects. These tend to be more of the type of work you all do, a lot of habitat restoration, riparian restoration, a lot of urban parks, tree planting, trail systems. Several of the projects that were mentioned by other funders today are projects we've invested in, including the Kerber Creek down in Sawatch. We've done a lot with Sand Creek here in the Denver metro area. We've done a lot of work with the Tamarisk Coalition on the West Slope. So that tends to be one of our major areas where we make grants. And then we have sort of more special projects, partnerships. These tend to be more in the urban areas where they're kind of more about neighborhood improvement, kind of community redevelopment, parks, urban gardens, community tree planting. And these we really look for opportunities where we can engage our employees as volunteers. And a lot of times the geography helps determine that. If we have projects in an area where we have a lot of employees, we'll try to leverage the volunteerism piece. And the third category, we do very few of these, but it's a possibility when great projects come our way, and it's an environmental awareness. And these tend to be, sometimes they're exhibits or displays at museums. Other times they might be sort of traveling educational opportunities around some sort of natural resource conservation. The most recent example in this arena is the last 2 years we've made grants to the Colorado Foundation for Water Education, helping to support the Water 2012 initiative and help to fund some of the displays and programming that was happening around the state around water. So with these guidelines, I should start with a caveat, and I had mentioned this to Kristen. For the last several months, we've been doing some major strategic planning here within the company, looking at the future of our foundation and where we're going and how to better measure the impact of our grants. Because we are not an endowed foundation and we get the money every year from our shareholders, we internally have to make the case of how we're making a difference in our communities. And so trying to do a better job of having more clear guidelines and descriptions and measurements that each of our grantees will report back to us so that we can keep reporting to our board of directors about how these investments are really improving our service territory. So these guidelines that I'm going over right now are still in development and will be final approval will come from the board at the beginning of March. But they're pretty close to being final. When they are launched and you see the final version on our website, they might change slightly. But this is really core to what we do and what we want to invest in. So it shouldn't change much, but just a small caveat on that. Eligibility and restrictions. These are also all listed on our website. There's a lot of restrictions, so I didn't put them here, but some of the most important ones I thought were relevant to this audience. The lead applicant for any of our applications has to be a 501c3. We fund a lot of environmental projects that are on public land and even some with private landowners, but the grantee organization has to be a 501c3. And the one that's trickiest often, especially for our environmental partners, is a project has to be within Xcel Energy's service territory, meaning a part of the state where we are either the provider of electricity or natural gas or both. Often some of these projects are out and sometimes feels like the middle of nowhere, and it's difficult to tell if they're in our service territory, so we can always answer those questions and help people figure out if the project is eligible. On our website, we have a list of all of the towns that we serve. The way the grid is set up, it doesn't seem logical, and so it's literally our territory. It's town by town versus counties or regions of the state. Easy way to know if you're in the territory is if you pay a bill to Xcel Energy. Government entities and K-12 schools and individuals are not eligible on their own. Like I said, they could be part of a collaboration with a nonprofit, but the money has to flow through a 501c3. Research, capital projects, and endowments are not eligible. This is one where we don't fund capital campaigns. Sometimes the larger environmental projects are sort of capital, but we've been able to still support those because we tend to do things like the trails and trees and things that our board sees as not sort of bricks and mortar. So there's always some flexibility on that, and I like to talk to people in advance if they're not sure if the project is a fit. And then, again, we have a strong interest in funding collaborative projects that engage nonprofit, public, and private sector organizations. Those rank more highly than individual projects. I think it's a strength in the environmental community that you all do collaboration really well. And somewhat related to that, Kristen highlighted the Colorado Collaboration Award as a funding opportunity that's out there right now. Xcel Energy is one of the funders of that award, and I chair the Application Review Committee each year. So if any of you are interested in the Collaboration Award or you have questions about that, you can also contact me with questions about that award in addition to Xcel Energy funding, and my contact info is at the end. So, evaluation criteria, I saw this was similar to a couple of the other applications that were highlighted today. We really look at agency capacity and the ability to manage the funds and have the proper staffing and resources in place to be successful on any project. The biggest piece we look at are the actual program or project design and the quantifiable impacts and past results of an agency. We like to fund groups that have had past success, and we like to help them grow and expand and do more with that. So the bulk of the application points come in those two areas. The other piece then, opportunities for Xcel Energy employee engagement. We really do like to find projects that we can engage our employees as volunteers or advisors and get them involved in what we're doing out in the community. So that's another somewhat unique to us, I think. And then we really look at the financial position and sustainability of the lead organization, but also the project. We tend to do smaller grants. A large grant for us tends to be $25,000. So we are rarely the biggest funder or the only funder. We really like to see that there's lots of other support for the projects and that there's going to be ongoing support for maintenance and continuing it after our grant ends. The process is the other piece that's being finalized right now. So we don't have our exact deadlines, but what we're expecting it to be is that our environmental partners will be able to apply between March 11th and April 5th. We do all of our grant-making process through an online system, which we're launching a brand new one right now. So current partners that are eligible under these guidelines will be directed to the new online system to go ahead and submit applications this year. New applicants or folks we haven't worked with before will talk to me, and we'll discuss their eligibility and if they're a fit, and if it seems like it fits with what we're trying to do, they'll get instructions on how to apply. Our grants range from $5,000 to $25,000, depending on the scope of the project, other funders that are involved, and the quantifiable impact. We don't have a requirement for any specific match or leverage funds, but again, we never want to be the only funder, and so we really like to see who else is involved, and there's a lot of local support for these projects, but there's not a requirement of dollar for dollar or anything like that. And here is my contact info. If you go to our website link right now, you'll see some basic information about the grants, and then a note that everything is changing and the new information will be posted in March. So what you're seeing here today is sort of hot off the press of what we're moving forward to the board, but it'll all be on the website right after that board meeting, so around March 11th. You can call me or email me before then if you have questions or a project you want to sort of pre-vet to see if it might be appropriate to apply. Try to have conversations with people as much as possible before the application so we can really narrow it down to what's your best chance of getting funded. So that's all I have for right now.
Great. Thank you so much, Shanda and everyone, for presenting. Obviously, that was a great deal of information presented in a condensed period of time. And so I hope we have some questions. We have only about 6 minutes until 1 p.m., and I know some of our presenters had some deadlines and other meetings at 1. So if you do have a question, please press star 1, and we'll try and get those answered as soon as possible. If We don't have enough time to answer those. Again, all of this information will be posted on our website as well as the recording, and so you can contact all of these people or contact me at kjesperson@tamariscoalition.org with questions about how to contact people and about their programs. We're also requesting that you fill out an evaluation survey. I've passed the link to the chat so that you can access that. One question that I had for a few of our presenters is about monitoring funding. Brian mentioned this during his presentation, that they do not really, Wetlands for Wildlife program, have something that's specifically focused on monitoring, but they do allow masses to be used for that component. I didn't notice in Naomi, Dave, or Shanda's presentation whether those programs specifically do or do not fund monitoring. So I wonder if any of you had thoughts on that you could address that question, or whether that's funded through your programs and just wasn't mentioned.
This is Shanda. We generally do not. The exception is kind of in the environmental education. Like, for example, we fund Colorado Watershed Assembly for the Riverwatch program, where they're sort of teaching kids to do it, but we don't really do it as kind of project basis.
Okay.
This is Naomi, and we have not typically supported and funding monitoring projects. Though through some more thorough evaluation of the legislation, we do have to make sure that monitoring would be reasonably acceptable or not. And so, if someone does have a particular question or about the project, I certainly encourage them to give me a call or shoot me an email.
Okay. So that means that might change in the future?
Not necessarily change in the future, but if there is an interest in monitoring, I would need to do some deeper evaluation of the legislation to see if that's an appropriate fit with the intent of the program based off of the legislation.
Okay. Gotcha.
And as far as SEPs are concerned, this is Rachel. We have funded monitoring projects in the past, although it gets a little bit tricky for us as well. So it's definitely not a clear category of acceptable project, although we have funded them.
And at the Colorado River District, the monitoring that we would be able to support in our grant program is essentially limited to water quantity measurement. However, if it's associated with watershed action, sometimes we could do some monitoring as part of a larger project, but monitoring in and of itself is probably not a good fit for our program.
Okay.
This is Chris with CWCB. I thought I'd weigh in real quick. We will fund monitoring as part of a project, and oftentimes we identify a need for monitoring for projects that we fund, and we'll enroll that project in our measurable results program, which is primarily geomorphic monitoring, a lot of survey, and some vegetation monitoring as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a great model for other grantors to consider, is building those measurable outcomes, or building monitoring as a component of projects and measurable outcomes in the future, because it is one of the most reliable means of ensuring a project actually has the impact that it intends to. So for those of you, if you are undergoing some types of revisions for your grants and the types of outcomes, the IFPIT model is a good one to examine, at least with regard to invasive plant removal and revegetation. I'm not getting any questions from our audience members. I think we maybe have stunned them with the amount of information that we have provided. And we are at 12:59, so we're right on time. So I am going to just request that if anyone who participated in the call does have questions, email me and I will channel those to our presenters. I want to thank each of our presenters very much for participating in this event. It took a fair amount of logistical coordination. And all of you provided a great overview of your programs, and I'm excited to get our partnership more tapped into these resources. And so thank you very much. Are there any final thoughts or questions from our presenters?
No, thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kristen.
Thank you.
Take care.